This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Hi, ladies and gentlemen. I didn't forget you, Ian. welcome again to Landmark Women. Just before I hand over to Katrina, who is going to introduce Dr. West for us today, I just wanted to remind you that in October, it won't be the third Friday. It's actually, it's technically the fourth Friday, the 23rd, that we're going to have Christine Waring, who is a milliner and has been creating hats for Canberra's fashionable ladies and ladies interstate, particularly for the racing season. And as it is October, I am going to ask everyone to wear a hat. And I might be giving a prize. we have our Encounters exhibition starting at the end of November. It's an amazingly important exhibition for the museum, and it is going to be fantastic. And we are going to be doing a preview breakfast on the 25th of November. So I am going to give away two tickets to that, to the best hat. But certainly, in the next few weeks, I will open up tickets for that breakfast, and I really hope that everybody who can come does, because it's going to be quite a significant and important event for the museum. Okay, I'll hand over to Katrina, who is the manager of the development unit. Thank you.
Thanks, Carice. Can you all hear me? I've sometimes been accused of not speaking loudly enough. No? Good? Good. I'm doing my best projection. Welcome this morning to a beautiful spring morning, and we thought it fitting, given the change in the weather and the focus on plants and the focus on Floriade and the focus on things regenerating, that we invite Dr. Judy West, who's the Executive Director of the Australian National Botanic Gardens, to join us this morning. So I'm really excited that she's accepted that invitation and will shortly be coming up here to talk a little bit more about her life, her passions and her interests. But by way of background, I just have some very short notes that I want to give you a bit of a sense of Judy's background and a sense of her amazing achievements. Dr. West oversees the Parks Australia Science and Natural Resource Management activities. So she's very interested in botany, and her work is extensive. She has written countless publications and is now, for her contributions to Australian plant systemics, she has been awarded the Nancy Burbridge Memorial Medal in 2001, and in 2003 she was awarded the Order of Australia for her considerable work in this area. Judy has more than 25 years' experience in scientific research and policy. As a research scientist, she's worked at the CSIRO in plant industry and as a director of both the Centre of Plant Biodiversity Research and the Australian National Herbarium, which, as some of you may know, is a herbarium that is collecting a lot of data about Australian plants. So I'm sure Judy will give us much more information about the nature of that project and her involvement with it. Judy also is currently holds the adjunct professorial position at the Australian National University, so her work is obviously well regarded and highly acclaimed, and she's it's a delight to introduce Judy and to invite her to speak a little bit more about the small and light glimpses that I've given you this morning and her amazing work in plants and biodiversity. Judy, if you'd like to come to the stage.
Can you hear me there? That good enough? Yeah. Thank you very much, Katrina, and thank you all for inviting me to talk to you today. Don't often talk about myself, so lots of other talking to do, but not so much about me. But It's really appropriate, as Katrina said, because I'm coming from a kindred institution as this, in terms of national institutions that do like work, and it doesn't matter what the collections are we work on, but basically they're much the same, and the things that flow through it. So I'm basically a plant scientist, a botanist that's done a few other things along the way in the last 65 years. But thinking of my journey and thinking about what I talked to you about made me think more about collections. And really the theme that we both have is about collections. And I've probably been... collections have run through my life pretty much, even where I am now at the gardens, of course. So, and that's obviously very similar to what happens in the museum, just different sorts of collections, but you obviously have similar interests. And a lot of historical interest in that as well. So I grew up on a farm of mixed agriculture and grazing. My two brothers are still on the land there at Harden, so it's not very far away, as most of you have probably been through Harden-Murrumburra or somewhere there. So it's quite close by, and as I said, my family's still there, and we see each other a fair bit. I had a great childhood, I think, growing up on a farm. It's probably a privileged lifestyle, really, in terms of just activities and what you learn about life and everything else. We were in those circumstances a family of five children, and I think the district used to think my father used us as slave labour on the farm, because we were very much horse oriented, and much more than now with bikes and things everywhere. But we did a lot of the work on the farm with mustering and things. In those days, obviously, many farms had workmen on there besides the family, and I particularly used to like working with them. We all did correspondence school, actually, until high school. Because I liked doing that so much, my father used to organise most of those mustering sort of things later in the week. So as long as I'd done all my homework and all the work for correspondence in the first part of the week, I was allowed to go out and do all the stuff that later in the week, which I loved. So a fairly horsey sort of family, but lots of show riding and that sort of thing. My first trip to New Zealand was actually on a pony club show jumping tour. So at 10, I went to boarding school in Sydney. At 10, it's pretty young, really. There was no in the local school. There was nothing above the intermediate stage, and so we went off to Sydney to boarding school. In the first year I was there, I topped the class the last time I ever did it, first and last time I ever did it. But what that does is give you a pretty good the high standards that the Blackfriars Correspondence School is, and still our school of the air is much the same from talking to people in remote areas of Australia, and we have a bit to do with that with Parks Australia, with our big parks that are out there. So, I had done in that first year when I was at boarding school, I had actually done a lot of the work already, so it was just, that sort of standards that are there, which is fantastic thing for Australia. But when I think about it, and I've thought about it a lot really the last few years, but basically I never went home again really. I did went home for holidays and things and all that time. But basically I went from school to university, went to Adelaide to work, and I'll talk about that a bit more. But then I came back to Canberra, which is much closer, of course, to Harden. But I never lived at home as such. My two other sisters did at different times, but not me. I probably don't suffer from it, but I never really had a good relationship with my parents as an adult, I guess. I had a good relationship with them, but never living with them in that time. Sounds a bit dramatic, I realise, but it's basically true. Basically, once you sort of go away, if you take on other things, you don't go back again. But I enjoyed my years at boarding school. There were some differences and things the way it happened. I was pretty homesick for the first couple of years. But my cohort was the first year of the high school certificate in New South Wales. So we were the top of the school for two years running, and I was head prefect for both of those years. It was an all-girls school, and I, as most of them were at that stage, single-sex schools. And I'm pretty sure I wouldn't be where I am now if I hadn't been at that school, especially in terms of science, the science programs that ran there. I probably wouldn't have got, having that grounding was probably a very big significant part of where I am now. And then I went straight to university, to Sydney Uni, and did a science degree, honours in botany, and I'll talk a bit more about that. I had a very active university life and worked hard as well. I lived for a while there, and I was in a college for a while, and then lived in a little flat thing in Newtown then. It wasn't anything like it is now. It was a pretty gruesome place to live. But we had two of us, one girl in the house was doing vet and I was veterinary science. The other one was doing an arts course. And we used, sometimes our parents would give us, you know, food when they came down from the farm or something, and you have chops in the fridge and stuff. And Helen that was doing the arts course, you'd come home at night thinking you were going to have this, and she'd already eaten it because she's there during the day all the time. And we usually have to full time at university, you know, with prep classes and stuff. Anyway, it was fine, but it's just one of those things that happens. I ended up in when I started in CSIRO a long time ago, and they do a security sort of clearance on you starting in Commonwealth government. I found I still had an ASIO record, which was from being in the clink overnight one night with the Vietnam protests. I don't know whether they're still there. I don't know how you get rid of those because it was a long time afterwards, really. And it went. So why botany? And I think the person with the greatest influence on me as in the direction of my career was, and lots of people say this to you later, was probably my senior professor at university, Roger Carolan. Very inspiring teacher, sort of analysed things to the level that you might want to, whatever level you wanted to do to work on it, but engendered interest in you and what you might do, and a stimulus. He led me to think about investigating plants. He was also a bit of a character himself, and you know, he used to get on the train. He used to knit coming to work on the train, which was pretty unusual for a man then. Anyway, he led a lot of his field work when we were in the field in thongs, as you know, some people do. They wouldn't be allowed to nowadays with the OH&S and work health and safety things that we have to follow. But Roger was a great influence on me. He's still alive and lives down at Berry, and I see him now and then. So a very stimulating person to work with. What I do is systematic botany, which is like taxonomy, and I'll explain a little bit of that, but some of you probably know what it is. So you have to be very rigid and attention to detail in this, which Roger wasn't. That didn't matter because you had a lot of the other things around you. So he provided all the context and the bigger thinking for you to think about what you're doing and giving you confidence about what you could do. Of course, that followed my influence really in growing up in amongst crops and agriculture situation and thinking about on the property where some plants were growing, what they were doing, different crops in different soil types, you know, what happened. So you realise you were thinking about that at that time. We had quite a lot of rocky outcrops that were fenced off from rabbits and things on the place, so you're already dealing with sort of native plants and looking at trees and where they occur. So my honours in botany was actually in taxonomy, and so being plant taxonomy, you know, what species do we have where, what the classification system, where do they grow, what do we know about them, how do they function, that sort of thing. My honours project was on a very small little plant, little gardenia, if any of you are planty-oriented. It doesn't have a common name, I don't think, brought in all sorts of parts of the discipline itself. There was none of the molecular sort of analyses and genetic analyses that are very common now and we do every day in our research things now. None of that was occurring at that time. And all those sort of facilities and access for technology, we just hadn't happened. So the other thing that happened at that time, they did courses in an honours course, and some universities still do this. You might do some coursework as well of an undergrad course. And I chose to do a third year geography course, physical geography course at the time. And it was really great. It was coastal geography, Twydale was the and some of you might have heard of him. He was a very famous coastal geomorphologist in Australia. And when I have a house down at Naruma, and so now I can understand and describe what the dune systems are doing and the rock platforms and things. Anyway, it just gives you another thought about a different angle for plants, which is good. In early 1972, I was married and moved to South Australia. And I worked in the botany department there in the University of Adelaide as a lecturer and doing my PhD at the same time. So when I was I wanted to, you know, do the PhD at the same time as it, which meant it took a lot longer, not longer than normal PhD would do, which is about 3.5 years. Mine was longer than that. And I worked on a group of plants called hot bushes, Dodonia, that grow widely in Australia, probably everywhere except high alpine areas. Great genus, and one of these groups, in you know, talking historically, that basically no one had looked at this genus in Australia, had treated it in terms of a systematic look at what do we have, what is it consist of since Bentham, George Bentham, in 1860s. As a British botanist that did collecting in Australia and then worked from Kew Gardens, which I'll talk a little bit more about later. So, I spend a lot of time in South Australia when the National Trust in South Australia, some of you may know this, is one of the few national trusts that actually manages native properties, like reserves, natural reserves. And most of the national trusts manage buildings and things. They had buildings as well, but they often were left, donated properties, and they didn't know what was on them. So a few of us used to go and do formal surveys on weekends and things of these new National Trust properties. So that was great and would keep you occupied during the weekends. But it was a lot of work but did a lot of good collecting as well from these areas which were new to the reserve system. So that was just sort of adding to the National Park sort of processes. I also did, I've seen a lot of Australia through doing field work for my research as a student and later, when I was in CSIRO as well. And the field work, we ran on a smell of an oily rag in those days and did it as best you could, sometimes your own vehicles, sometimes work vehicles, whatever. But I did manage to see a lot of especially South Australia and Western Australia in that time, because that's where the concentration of... I didn't have enough information about them. The species I'm talking about have separate... They're dioecious, two houses, separate male and female plants, and they're wind-pollinated. And from herbarium specimens, which I'm sure you all know what herbarium specimens, dried plant specimens, if people had collected these without really noting down in detail that they'd actually taken something from two different plants, so you have a specimen, two specimens, two bits of plant on a sheet, and if you couldn't, you might not be able to tell that they'd actually come from the same plant or two plants. And if they weren't flowering or, whatever. So you actually needed to look at the population in the field so you could actually get an idea of was this species totally two houses, two separate male and female plants, because it's a group that's been evolving towards total two houses. So it has some plants, some species, one house, all the flowers on one plant, and others have worked right through to two houses, total separation. So it's a really interesting group from an evolutionary point of view to look at, and so that was what I needed to do the fieldwork. Well, that's what I said anyway. It was good doing the fieldwork anyway. A few adventures I have with these sort of big field trips. I'll just tell you about a couple. In 1975, when I was at Adelaide, I had some money from a grant from a grant program that I now run. But anyway, it was a very small amount of money to go and do some field work in southwest Western Australia, and I had another colleague coming with me, and we were going in the old four-wheel drive from the botany department, and I was asked at the last minute to take two other young students who just started their PhDs and needed to see some of their plants in WA, and I said, yeah, that's fine, and so four of us set off. And I said it was an old vehicle that we had. Seemed to be pretty good, but we got as far as Nullarbor Homestead. And this was... did any of you drive across the Nullarbor before it was sealed? Before it was bitumen? Yes. Yeah? Okay, so we... Yeah, this was 1975, was dirt bitumen, dirt road. And we got to Nullarbor Homestead had a break, came back to the vehicle, and there was water all over the floor, over the ground outside, and the water pump had broken. And here we are. We had you don't have spare water pumps everywhere. And so then we decided, well, we had a big confab of what we were going to do about it. It was a Sunday, and I rang the lab manager his home number from the botany department. I said, you're going to have to get a water pump out here. And we decided we'd go on to Eucla, because it was more likely that a plane or something would come into Eucla than Nullarbor Homestead, so we thought. He wasn't very pleased with me, of course, but he said he'd do it. So we went on with a big 4-gallon drum on the top that we kept stopping and topping up the radiator, so we didn't burn out the engine. And we went on. The other thing about this time, the Nullarbor, when it wasn't sealed, is, and you had to know this, it really took a while, trying to overtake semi-trailers or road trains when you've got just a ball of dust at you and you had no idea what was ahead. It took us a while to work out, but what they do is they move over onto the wrong side of the road. So then there's nothing coming. But you're still going, you're driving through a wall of dust, hoping to God they're right, because they can see a long way ahead, of course. And it took us a while to work it out, but that's the sort of protocol that had built up between the truckies. And I talked to lots of people afterwards who had also been through the same process of pretty dangerous stuff to do, but you couldn't see to overtake at all. And you couldn't even see when you did overtake on the wrong side, but you're trusting them. Some of Australia's techniques that we engender, I suppose. So we got to Eucla, and those of you who have been across there will know Eucla is one of these places that sort of gathers strange people. Odd bods from all around the world sort of gather together, and there were a lot of characters there. It was great fun. But, we ended up there much longer than we thought we were going to be. And at Eucla, you're on the roads up here, and the dunes are down, and you follow down into the to the sea. And the bight there. And the airstrip is down there as well. So we sort of camped in, that we were camping all the time, of course, and we camped in the top, up on the ridge. And the first day, you know, I didn't think I didn't know whether they'd get the pump to the bus, the plane down that day or not. But anyway, so we waited till the plane landed and raced down there to see if he had the water pump. And no, he didn't have that water pump that day. And the next day, so I got on to dug again and got stroppy. And he said, "Yeah, no, we took it there." And so I said, "We'll put another one on there." And anyway, then the next day, no plane came. And what had happened is they'd got to Nullarbor Homestead and they thought, "Oh, we've only got a parcel to go to Eucla, we'll go back home." So we didn't have that. So then I decided, well, maybe we'll try the other end. And so we decided to... I rang a Toyota company in Perth who didn't know me from a bar of soap and asked him if he would get... Because buses come through, you know, obviously from south, from WA. And if he'd get deliver a water pump to the bus station that... I've forgotten who the bus company was. And they said, "Oh, yeah, they'd do that and stuff." Anyway, so the next day, when we thought, "Oh, it'll be coming through," the bus comes through, and it had a group of dancing girls on it. That's what they call them, dancing girls. And it had gone from their place instead of going from the depot. And so they didn't have a water pump either. Anyway, so during this 4 days, we'd had quite a time, obviously, with the... we'd collected every plant there was in the region, and we'd been doing our work as well. We'd been obviously getting to know the locals and playing pool with them and stuff at night and things, and they were starting to bet how long we were going to be there. And then they had an old four-wheel drive they used to use for rescuing people off the road, you know, that sort of go out and help people. And so we'd bet them, say, "Well, okay, we'll take your... if we can get your water pump out of your vehicle and put in ours, can we have it?" You know, and they said, "Oh, yeah, yeah." Anyway, so by the time we'd been 5 days, I said, "Right, we're going to have a go at this." And so I had two men and another young woman and myself. Having grown up on a farm, we'd done a fair bit of mechanical work. And when I first started things, I did a sort of mechanics course. Couldn't do this nowadays because you've got computers everywhere in the cars. Anyway, so we decided it one night we'd have a go and try and get this out. And it took ages. The other guy that was with me was absolutely hopeless. And anyway, we managed to get it out and got it into our vehicle. One of the mechanics came and had us a little bit of help, but basically they were standing by watching to see if we'd get it to work. And we did, and off we drove with the water pump, and did all the distance around southwest WA with that same water pump in the vehicle. And three other water pumps were delivered to three new ones. To Eucla, and our lab manager really, really blew off of me. He thought it was a really bad deal and I should try and get them from them. They were about $20 then. And so we left Eucla with three water pumps. Anyway, so things happen. But our collections from around Eucla are very well known now. There's a very good collection in different herbaria around Australia. So one of the things with herbarium collections is that we can collect... When you collect an animal, you've obviously got a single specimen, except for invertebrates and things. But when we collect plants, we often collect duplicates. That's a sort of protocol to do. And so we would... You're calling a duplicate. You've taken a branch and you take it into smaller pieces. And so we almost always would collect duplicate specimens. So we, in Australia, we send them to other herbaria. So there's a bit of an insurance in case any of us get burnt down or something happens to material. So we had our collections from there got well distributed around Australia. Another field trip I did, this was after I was in CSIRO, in 1981, in northern Australia. So I needed to look at some of the Northern Territory, top Kimberley area. Went up there for some other work, and then I managed to find an old bushy who did... he worked in CSIRO Forestry at the time, based in Darwin, and he was sort of formally collecting seed for the Australian Tree Seed Centre, which is mostly distributed overseas, and so bulk seed. And he wanted to get out to some of these same areas, so we went his vehicle, and I had some money for it. So anyway, he was a character. And the food, when I'm going on field trip, even though you're camping and stuff, you can still eat decent food and stuff. And he said he'd do all the food to start with. And we were about 3 weeks or something, I think. And it turned out to be bully spam, you know, that spam tin stuff. And I couldn't stand it after the first couple of days. So I took over the food after a while. But you can only stop in certain places then. It wasn't, you know, to find food. But we went out first to the Eastern Northern Territory, towards McArthur River, Borroloola area. The McArthur River at that time was a dry riverbed at the time. And, the crocs will be fine. We can just sleep in the riverbed. And we had sort of stretcher-type things as camping. Most of the time you didn't need anything to sleep on. Anyway, so I was sleeping out in the river, and I woke up partway through the night, and he wasn't beside me. He was somewhere else. And I found he was on the bloody roof of the vehicle. And he decided he wasn't to stay there. But he left me there and didn't say anything to me. to wake me up to move. Then when we got across the... he was a great person to do field work with. And we got to the into the Western Australia and going across, you know, sort of from Catherine West, the rivers. And so this was straight after the wet season. From my experience with Kakadu now, which we look after, the clearing of the crossings and everything on the roads and stuff after the wet season is a major, major piece of work that we have to do every year for Kakadu. But it happens all through those northern Kimberley routes as well. And we knew that we were probably the first to be going through, and we'd been trying to get information from both Northern Territory and WA roads, and, you know, to find out whether they'd cleared particular roads or not. And some had been cleared, some not. They didn't even know what the state of the roads were, sort of, because, you know, they're impassable until the rains sort of stop. And it wasn't raining at all, but it was a lot of water around. And we got to the Pentecost River, and we really weren't sure how deep it was at all in terms of the vehicle. So Ken says, can you go and test the, you know, what it was? And so I said, you mean walk through it? And he said, yeah, go through it. So I took my boots off, and then I had trousers on. Long knee ones. So I took them off too, and I'm not quite sure why I did that. Anyway, so we get to the other side. I walked across. It was up to here, sort of waist one, and the vehicle went through fine. And then when he got to the other side, some people had pulled up on the other side. Here's me standing in my underpants, soaking wet. And then he drove off as if he didn't know who I was. Anyway, it was sort of, but the worst thing we had was funnier, sort of looking back. When we got to after a few days in the Kimberley, we were trying to come back to Northern Territory, crossing the Victoria River, and it was, well, I'm going to say no one had been across it, but someone had attempted. So we get to the outside of it, and there was silt built up, you know, that really fine silt. It's unbelievable. So the vehicle sort of went okay for one, then suddenly went down, and we managed to winch ourselves on a tree that was a big tree that was right down the side of the river to get over that first time, to get onto the river, and then we got across the causeway, because the actual crossing was a cement causeway. But on the other side, and we could see them when we first pulled up, was an old Holden station wagon upside down, and a whole lot of Aborigines sitting around, lying around. Anyway, they got stuck as well, so they turned the vehicle up the other way, thinking they'd get it out easy, get it out and be able to drag it off. But they hadn't. They were just sitting around, and someone had gone off to the Victoria River down station to get a Ferguson tractor to come back and pull it up. so they were sort of there partway in the road where we had to get across, and we sort of got across the first part, and then the vehicle went down all four, and we were right on the belly. It was totally bogged. And it was, I don't know, really hot weather. It was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So we had to try and dig it out. No mobile phones, none of all that stuff, of course. But we knew we were only about 15 kilometres from Victoria River down station and Kidman Springs, where my husband and another person were doing work, and we were going to meet at Kidman Springs that night. And so we knew, someone knew we were supposed to be getting somewhere. But we were hours digging this thing out. And the spades that the Aborigines had were sort of straight. They were homemade ones, so they were much easier than our things to get under the vehicle. So we were using their things. They just lay around and chatted to us, which was fine, and drinking as they were. But they weren't drunk. They were just having fun. And their tractor, their Fergie tractor, turned up. Ferguson tractor, and if you know what that is, a pretty light little tractor. And of course, it didn't pull us. They wanted to try pulling us out with the Ferguson, and it just was rearing up, and, you know, there was no way it was. And we weren't enough big trees on the side for us to winch onto. So we were digging and digging and digging, and eventually guys from the water board turned up to do the measurements on the water. They didn't know we were there. And these guys were sort of said, oh, no, we can drive past you. And I said, well, I think it's pretty wet out there. You know, they were going to go around the side of us as they did, and they went over to the side. And this arrogant guy said, you know, looked at me as if so stupid woman wouldn't know what she's talking about. It's not wet there. And then they go there, and they were stuck as well. And so but they weren't on the road. They were on the side. And then we finally, by the time Ian and Martin realised that there must have been something wrong and they'd driven out to... You know, so with their vehicle, we managed to get out, but it took us something like 6 hours or something to get out. And then we drive on to Victoria River Down Station and there's 15 helicopters sitting on the, you know, on the ground. It was a big exercise in those days. But what happened, the Aborigines were sort of laughing at me and I had just, you know, shorts and T-shirt and boots on by then. And I said, what are you laughing at? And they thought, oh, you're the same colour as I am. And I was totally covered in mud. Anyway, it was a quite humbling situation by the time you got to see what were the facilities on Victoria River Down Station. You know, all those helicopters sitting there and there were we digging this thing out in hands. But a good experience. Anyway, that was fun. So I resigned from my position in the University in Adelaide to finish up my PhD. It had just been taking too long and I decided to stop doing that and to finish the PhD. And I spent my time between the herbarium in Adelaide, which is in the Botanic Gardens, and the university, which are almost beside each other, just a bit of North Terrace and bits in between. So that was good, getting it finished up. And then I moved to Canberra to CSIRO. And that's an interesting thing, looking at recruitment process that I went through or not. The processes then compared to, and we're talking about 1980 this was, compared to what we've been doing with the recruitment process in the public service in the last 18 months or so, it's been a nightmare, some of you would know about. I actually had applied for a job in ANU, and that's why I was still in Adelaide, and in botany, I think it was called Botany School then, School of Botany in ANU, and I was offered this job. But in the meantime, Jim Peacock, who was the chief of CSIRO Plant Industry at the time, he's still working in CSIRO, and some of you probably know his name, a pretty famous scientist. He had contacted me via someone else about a job he had in CSIRO Plant Industry in the herbarium, and it was about to advertise, and I said, yes, I'd be really interested. But he said, well, you certainly got the job. And I said, well, you know, is it going to be advertised? What's happening? And I didn't want to, obviously, I would have preferred the position in CSIRO than ANU, just for a whole lot of reasons at the time. And I didn't want to obviously reject the ANU one and then not have another job or accept the ANU one and then leave it soon. That was not a practice I would do. And so I was trying to find out from him how long it was going to be to find out about the job in CSIRO. So I rang finally got to ringing his assistant, who said, oh, yeah, she'd ask him about it. And what I said to her was, you know, she said, no, I'm sure it's your job. And I said, well, you know, if I take this other one, I don't have anything at all in paperwork from CSIRO to say, what if he gets run over by a bus next week? No one's, you know, going to tell. So next thing I have this phone call saying, you know, I hear you've been wishing bad things of me and death. And anyway, it was Jim. And so I did that job. And it was some years later that he was got on a bus in Sydney, and he happened to sit beside a woman with a painting. And it turned out to be my aunt, one of my mother's sister. And they got talking, as they do. Both of them talk quite a lot, and they found, you know, obviously she discovered that it was me that he knew about, and he said. And she said, oh, I believe you, you know, employed me. And he said, yes, I always go for the best person I can get in that position at the time, of course. And he never said that to me, of course, and he's probably telling a lie anyway, but that was something I never knew about. It's a typical Jim, he wouldn't have told me that at all, why I got appointed. Having moved to Canberra, and then I thought, well, maybe 10 years in CSIRO, you know, you don't sort of, I guess, plan how long you're going to be in a place. 30 years later, I left CSIRO to go to the position I'm in now. Just shows you it was probably a pretty good place to work. It has a lot of ups and downs and still is going through ups and downs, but it actually, CSIRO is a great place to work. And the bigger picture of it, it's bashed around by the government all the time and others, and then it puts itself through lots and lots of reviews and processing. But overall, it is a very good institution and well respected in Australia. So that was for me was a great good grounding in science and whatever you could do, and lots of colleagues you can work with in different fields, which is a really good thing to do. I worked in the herbarium, Australian National Herbarium, and worked on a totally different group of plants, lots of things, but this time little succulent plants, Australian endemics again, and called Calandrinia. And they're very good horticultural products but aren't used very much yet. We're trying to bring some into cultivation much more in the gardens now. So worked on them and did some more field work about things. One of the things I was able to do in 1987-88, I competed for and was appointed as the Australian Botanical Liaison Officer based at Royal Botanic Gardens Kew in London. So at that time, Australia had a, and so did India and South Africa at the time, had these liaison officers based at Kew. Now, the main reason for that is the early collecting that was done in Australia by, you know, was it Joseph Banks or the Robert Brown collection. Robert Brown was the main botanist on Flinders Expedition, 1801 to 1805. Most of those specimens that they collected, of course, had gone back to Britain and were either in, most of them, Kew or the Natural History Museum in London. A lot of our material also was on European herbaria, like Paris and Vienna. Much of the Australian material was lost in Germany and Dresden and Berlin. I lost a lot of our material in bombing during the Second World War. Vienna did too, and Salzburg did as well. But some was put into vaults and things and underground. People realised the value of it and put it into safe, secure collections, and not just our collections, but all of their collection. So off we went in 1987 to Kew. Our oldest daughter was nearly five at the time, and Leah, the youngest one, was 18 months. And we went to... Ian was working at, he was on sabbatical from ANU and working at Imperial College at near Sunningdale, out near Ascot on the western side of London. And we decided we'd live there and I'd travel rather than the other way around so he could do the kids. And that's what we did. And at that time, you know, you don't think about it really, but Australia had pretty good childcare stuff even then, and especially home-based childcare with other people, which we'd been using here in Canberra, but that wasn't happening in Britain at all. It took us ages to find someone that Leah could actually, the younger one could be at. Kim was nursery school age, is what they called it there. That was all fun. They had a great time. Except Kim had been in, she'd actually been in a family daycare, family home-based field, what is it called now? No, at home, in someone's home, yeah? So, yeah, sorry. And it always had, we didn't think about it till we were in Britain, but she'd always had non-Western people in the groups that she was in. You know, she had Vietnamese, Indigenous, Native, Aborigines and all those things. When she got to Britain, she asked us about why were all these people the same as her? So the nursery school she was at was all, you know, and it was Ascot area, so it was probably likely. But anyway, that was a really great year. I had I had worked at Kew a couple of times before and visited, but lots of friends, colleagues and friends from now, you know, that I still keep in touch with. We had some here just recently. Very long-lasting and a great place to work, extremely good experience. So the liaison officer position is not all fun. It basically was designed to be... you were a liaison officer, basically. So you were helping people in Australia and New Zealand. We used to do it for New Zealand as well, to help them find material, find information. We didn't have libraries at that stage. A lot of the old material, which you have to look at for taxonomy, was in European herbarium. We didn't have copies of them or whatever. Nowadays, you know, it's all online, or most of it is. And the specimens were basically there. And the concept of a type specimen, I don't know if you know about this, but basically if you're looking at taxonomy, you have to work out what was the concept the person who described this new species, what was the concept they had in their head. And so the specimen they cite with what they publish is the main thing you have to look at again. And most of them were not in Australia. And so what we were doing was selecting material that might be borrowed from, formerly borrowed. There's a very big... exchange system that happens between herbaria around the world, a very strong protocol that's very safe and exchange material. We don't do it nearly as much now because a lot of imaging has happened, digitisation of the specimens, and that's less damage to specimens, less postage, all that sort of stuff. So I had to look at material and make judgments on something for if someone could give you enough details of what they wanted me to look at, you'd go and look at the specimen, find them in the collection and look at them for them. And the Australian stuff, of course, wasn't really actively worked on at Kew because they had enough other things. And most of Kew's scientific work is in much more to do with Africa and South America. So that was great fun. And sometimes, but people, and you also were answering queries from Britain as well. So anyone in the UK who had, and sometimes you'd, it landed with a whole lot of photographs, prints that someone had just been to WA and taken a whole lot of photos and asking you to identify them from the photos. That was a bit of a test. When I first got there, it was actually quite interesting. We just got fax machines. We had fax machines in Australia for about a year. And when I got to Kew, they still had their typing pool, women in the typing pool, all women, and they had the fax machine was in their typing pool. And I happened to be, when I left here, I was writing a paper with someone else in plant industry. And so it was pretty, I took a laptop with me, which also they weren't using really very much at the time. And it was a bit revolutionary, really, because we didn't have email or anything then. And Rudy and I, he was here in Canberra, so I'd work on this paper during the day, send it to him by fax, before send a manuscript by fax before I went home. I'd come back in the morning and he'd done his bit and it was back there. And so it was a 24-hour turnaround, which we hadn't had anything like that. So the fax machines were really revolutionary at that stage. But the women in the typing pool couldn't understand this fax machine. And so they couldn't work it out at all. And Ian had the same problem in Imperial College where they'd also got a new fax machine. And the person one day said that she'd send something to Australia for Ian. And she came back and she said, it's come back to me four times. And so the paper going through had come back to her. And she thought it was all going to go down the line or something. Anyway, they finally worked them out. It was just different technologies. Okay. Well, on Australia Day, we decided to have a party at Kew with a few people and to do an Australian thing. I managed to get, and I don't think it happened now, but I managed to get wine and beer out of the New South Wales and South Australian Embassy and the Australian Embassy. They're not called embassies. Consulate, yes, that's right. Anyway, they were really good, and that was fun. And being bicentennial year, of course, 1988 was... But anyway, we decided we had to make lamingtons. We were providing all the food for this thing. Neither of us had ever made... We do lots of cooking, but never made lamingtons before. And our kitchen... We lived in a really nice part of an old church, an 1830s church in Sunningdale. And the oven, it was fine, but it wasn't big enough for what we needed. So we went to... There was a nice little baker in Sunningdale, and we went and asked him if he'd make us this sponge cake, this by this. And he said, what the earth are you doing this for? And so we explained about lamingtons. And we, when we finally made them, and we kept some so they could try them, of course. But we covered our whole kitchen in chocolate and coconut everything for the night. But they were a hit, of course, and Kew. I mean, some people at Kew knew about them, but it was fun. And we did all sorts of things. And of course, we were living out at Sunningdale. We had to take it in on the M25, and we had pavlovas and all sorts of things in the car. It all went really well. But it was a funny thing because the bakery thought they were fantastic, and they started making them then for them. And Ian was back in Imperial College about 10 years ago, and they were still making and selling lamingtons. So that's good. Left a little bit of a mark on them. The other thing that happened being 1988, there were some actually really good articles on in the media about Australia at the time. Some of the time when you see things about Australia overseas, you cringe. But they were really good in about the bicentenary and all sorts of things. But we didn't realise, no one at Kew realised, obviously, that the school curricula had obviously put something in the curriculum about Australian plants and Joseph Banks. So the first week of January, we had this incredible amount of inquiries about Australia and Australian plants, inquiries from the public, from kids and everything. And it was happening about five or six were coming in a day. And I said, oh, God, we better do something about this. And then they found that no one, the school curriculum hadn't informed anybody that that's what they'd done, and they'd put it into the curriculum. So we had to make up a whole dossier and stuff about it, which was an interesting thing to do for another country. I did manage to visit other European herbaria while I was there. We did some driving to other places in Europe as well. But Paris and Leiden in the Netherlands have a lot of Australian material, and Vienna and Uppsala, which is the home of Linnaeus. So that was really interesting stuff to do. So to look at material, so I would go to those. If people had asked me, if you're going to these places, can you look at this specimen for me? Dunno. I'll see if you can find it. Finding it in some of the older herbaria is obviously a chore sometimes because they don't, the Australian material is not what they work on all the time, and it might be in the vaults or in another place. When I returned to CSIRO at the end of 1988, Jim Peacock, still chief of the plant industry, asked me to take on the program leader job, and I didn't want to do this because I thought I was too. I had wanted to do more research, and you know, once you start going into that role, you're not going to have as much time for research. And we debated about it for some weeks, months, and then I got the hint that I basically saying no was not going to work. And people kept saying to me, I don't think you can do this. You're not going to say no to him. So I took over a program which had very senior scientists in there and younger than, I mean, older than me and much more career, you know, in their careers, very good people. But in CSIRO, that doesn't really matter. It's not, you know, the hierarchy isn't as important as you find it when you're in the public service proper. So we had, it was basically, I was director of the herbarium at that time as well. It was we did a lot of innovative things. We're the first to sort of start doing using online systems for identification systems for plants and that sort of thing, multi-access keys and everything like that. In 1992, then we had two herbaria on Black Mountain. We had one in the Botanic Gardens and one in CSIRO, both owned by the Commonwealth. And we started to think, why don't we put these together? And so for a fair bit of time, we actually did bring them together into one. One unit, and that's what the Australian National Herbarium is now. And we also started in 1993 putting a centre around a research body around that. And so the Centre for Plant Biodiversity Research was formed then, which is a joint venture between basically the gardens as being part of the Department of Environment and CSIRO, plant industry. So we had the main body in Australia for plant sciences on plant research, and the main body that was responsible for managing on the ground at a national level, national parks and Australian national Australian National Parks and Wildlife Service. So that's what we brought together, and that still exists today. We've just had we've done two 10-year ministerial-level agreements between the two places, and for the gardens, this is fantastic because basically the centre does our research work. We haven't had to, you know, collaboratively, we haven't had to build up labs and all that sort of thing on the garden side. We do that work together, and they'd work a lot with us on the collection, the living collection as well. It's an extremely good partnership. And so I was there until I moved to CSIRO, to the gardens. So very good collaborative research. I better get a move on. So in the early 2000s then, we had every now and then, you know, in places like the research places, you have a poly visit. And Robert Hill at the time was Minister for Environment, and he came and visited the centre. And we showed him about the database that we had for the specimens that we had been working on and, you know, digitising all the information on them. And as he was walking out the door, he said, well, this has to be done for all of Australia. And we said, oh, yeah, okay. And he said, how much would it cost? And I said, on the doorstep, he was leaving. And I said, oh, 20 million out of my head. And anyway, so he was serious. For the next 2 years, basically, we worked across Australia and got all of the herbaria, of course, were very keen about it, but we had to get all the state governments online. But we did. He was fantastic. And basically got the... It was ministerial sign-off of all the ministers from each state and him to agree to form Australia's virtual herbarium. And so the goal was I got $10 million. We got $10 million for basically, we're estimating we had about 6 million specimens between us. This is just the Australian specimens, nothing collected from overseas. And so it started off the Australia's virtual herbarium. And now that is 6.5 million specimens have been databased from our major herbaria in Australia, all available online everywhere. It was a massive project for the herbaria. It's changed the way we did our work, changed everything. The museums have always been very jealous of us. But every time we did try it a few times before that to get to do that sort of databasing for all museums and herbaria. The museums have done their vertebrate collections, but the invertebrate collections are massive of them, and we're just not there. Trying to help them, but so it's been it revolutionised the way we work in herbaria, and we get saying that to the herbaria to start with. This is going to change everything you do, because you know, as you had to keep the specimens moving through, we had to employ a whole lot of databasing people. You had to have our staff had to have curated the collection before they were going in or doing it afterwards. It was very good, changed the way everyone works. So it was a massive thing. It's been modelled. The Chinese came and saw us unashamedly, wanted to copy it, and they have. With multi-million dollars more, but they literally used the same model totally. So, and Robert Hill, I saw him recently and he remembers all that happened. So he was really instrumental in getting, we had sign off from all the state agents, state government ministers, state environment ministers. So it was for that, Katrina mentioned before about me having Order of Australia. It was basically my work in systematic botany and getting the Australia's Virtual Herbarium up that I think that's why I was awarded. You're never quite sure what happened, who nominates you for those things. One of the things that happened, the Nancy Burbidge Memorial Medal he mentioned, I was the first one to receive that. That comes from the Australian Systematic Botany Society, Professional Society. And in 2001... we had a Flora Malaysiana meeting, so we've been working in that Malaysian region hosting the meeting in Australia. It was an international meeting at Sydney Gardens, and the 9/11 happened while we were there. And, you know, I woke up in the morning and someone came into my room and said, "My God, have you seen the television?" You know, it was just, you know, you all would have been through the same reaction. But I had to do the guest lecture that night. And, you know, everyone, because we had people there from all over the world and some people from America, of course, and everyone was really upset about what had happened with the 9/11 exercise. And anyway, they did this big introduction to me, you know, one person I know, and then I got up and just started talking. The whole thing was sort of, and I thought, oh my God, I didn't even say thank you for anything. And anyway, it was one of those worst sort of times you have to speak. Luckily, it was all planned and I had it sorted, but, you know, it was the feeling everybody had. And then, if you remember, ANSANT went bust 2 days later, and we had all these people in Australia who couldn't get out, and you know, especially the local, you know, this region, they couldn't. So it was a pretty massive, massive time to have to help and do things. I spent a year in 2003 on a task force in Department of Environment, Department of Education, Science and Training, and leading a task force on science and innovation mapping. So looking at the whole of Australia's sort of innovation, science and mapping areas for future directions of and came out with whopping great reports from that. Brendan Nelson was the minister at the time for education science. Things go round, don't they? In 2006, I had a bit of a setback. I had I got sick sort of partway through the year, and no one could work out. GP couldn't work out what was going on. After about 2 months of doing all sorts of tests of everything, and trying all sorts of things, and I kept getting sicker. And people, I was still at work, but people kept saying, "Something else wrong with you," you know, because I'd walk up the hill in Black Mountain, and I was puffing and could hardly. And coughing and sort of going on. And then it got worse and worse. And my younger daughter was living with me at the time. She was only 20. she was at uni. And I went off and had tests and all sorts of things. And then I ended up one time I was in emergency. I was getting really hot sweats at night and, you know, changed the bed twice a night and things sort of stuff. And we couldn't work out what was wrong. And then this guy diagnosed me with lymphoma. And my daughter was with me, and I did the wrong thing, and I refused her to tell my family at all because I thought this guy was wrong, and I was pretty sure he was wrong. He hadn't had any of the tests or, you know, anything, nodes that he should have been testing and stuff. Anyway, then I had MRIs, and we did full scans and things, and I was just so exhausted. And then I said, "Leo, I'm going to have to go back in the hospital. I can't do this." So this time I used the lymphoma to get out of emergency and get in there faster, which obviously worked. But it turned out, and then I was a week or something in hospital, so they were still testing, moving me from one department to another, working out what was wrong, until someone, they had the blood cultured, and it came back with a massive infection. And it turned out I had endocarditis. So basically bacteria had eaten holes in the valve, atrial valve of the heart. And so it was flapping around in the breeze. When they took me down to have this test, it was on a Saturday, and the scan, and Leah was with me, the daughter, and the technician said, he showed us what was happening, you know, it was just sort of flapping, the oxygenated blood obviously wasn't getting around the body. And he started telling us that it was the leaflets that weren't coming together and stuff, and Leah sort of slightly laughed, and he said, "Why, this is very serious." And she said, "Well, you're telling my mother, who's a botanist, that she's got leaflets around her body." Anyway, so the infection was bad enough that I had to have a week of solid antibiotics before they actually did any. So I had open heart surgery, and I've got a Teflon Dacron valve in the heart. Seems to be ticking away very well, and everything's fine. But I was 4 months before I could go back to work or whatever. And, you know, you go home and basically they're telling you you can't lift any more than a cup. And I was It was really frustrating, but that was true. It was, I felt like an old lady, very old lady, and made me realise what's going to happen in the future. And Leah was with me all that time. She was terrific, but she was doing exams at uni, which was tough. So my two sisters were wonderful, and they came and lived with us for 2 weeks and 3 weeks at a time. And my younger sister, who's on the farm at Wagga, she came and she was starting to do things out in the garden and all sorts of stuff, and I didn't want her to do this because I wanted to do it. And I'll be able to do that when I get stronger. And so we were having this great barning all the time. She was cleaning up the garden, which was great because she wanted to be busy. And I was telling my older brother, and he said, "Don't you remember? She's a control freak." But, you know, you don't often live with your siblings at that age. My other older sister was very much like a mum to us, and she was cooking away, and Leah thought it was fantastic. She was getting great food every night. So anyway, it was just shows you the family were fantastic and all of that, and still are. Leah lives in Canberra, but still, and she makes sure I'm all right every day. So she still looks after me. So that was the interesting thing was the cardiologist and the heart people had a disagreement about how long I'd actually had this in the body. And though some of them were saying it was 6 months or something, and there's no way it could have been because in June I'd walked the Larapinta Trek in Central Australia. So it, somewhere in that 2 month period before they diagnosed it was when I contracted whatever it was. The reason that apparently took a long time, if I go to another doctor anywhere now, like a GP, they want to know all about it because they don't get to see this sort of thing in what they're saying is healthy people. It's usually injecting drug users or something that end up with endocarditis. So they also told me I was too young to have I had to have an artificial valve because I was too young to have a cow valve because I was going to have to need another one in 15 years or something. So that's why it's artificial. But it seems to be working well. So in 2007 we did a big proposal for a big research hub of the Commonwealth Government, and we got that for $6 million for Trin. So that was right coming to an end when I moved to secondment to Parks Australia and to the Botanic Gardens. So moving from CSIRO to the public service, even though most people see CSIRO as public service, is a very different situation because we'd had the centre between the two places anyway. I'd worked a lot with the department and so knew a lot of people there. So it was not a hard transition for me, but it really is quite different in terms of that aspect. But what I've been really enjoying doing in the department, in government, is actually linking, some of you will know about this, the science policy end of things, trying to get results of good science taken up in policy or how you do that. And that's been really fun. We've built up the scientific aspects of Parks Australia as well quite a lot in the last 5 years. And I hadn't actually ever planned to work at a botanic gardens or to manage a botanic gardens, but I'm thoroughly enjoying it. And we've just had, some of you might have seen, we've done a master plan just recently of the gardens, and we're just planning building and conservatories and all sorts of things right now. So that's rejuvenated things as well to get things moving along those lines. But it has and the gardens has a very scientific base to it. So it was always designed in the first concepts of the gardens, these gardens, was that it would be a scientific gardens. That's why they located it between ANU and CSIRO, and that relationship is very close still. We do research work with both. But all the material that's in the gardens, all the plants growing in the gardens are vouchered, have a herbarium specimen vouchered in the herbarium. So it gives them that scientific validation. They are therefore a very well recognised collection worldwide, and so people ask to borrow or get material from us, especially now that people use just a few leaves to do DNA analyses or something, so they don't have to come to Australia if they're working on plants here or whatever, and they can ask to borrow to have some leaves. We don't borrow leaves, to have some leaves. Also, the seed bank is something that I've built up since I've been there. There was a seed bank there, but not a very big one and not active, and we've employed a seed conservation biologist and a new curator of the seed bank. So this is a conservation seed bank, so it's not providing seed for massive growing, restoring landscapes, but we do. It's a conservation seed bank, so we're talking about long-term storage, and for long-term storage, it could be thousands of years that those seeds should be able to be retained. What we do is work out germination protocols for them, and for every one of them is tested before they go into the seed bank, and to try and come up with a protocol really for each one of how you would grow it. Especially interested in some of the more horticultural potential species. We've got some really good horticulturists in the gardens. The gardens grows about a third of Australia's plants, which is a very good situation given our climate. So a third of Australia's flora is in this place, in the gardens. I've tried to get them to sort of focus a bit more on particular areas I've been there, and to focus on we sort of look at a couple of major ecosystems here: the grassland and grassy woodlands of the southeastern region, and the alpine subalpine, both of which it's recognised as ecologically endangered communities. So not only those, obviously the rainforest gully we have relationships with some of the gardens in Queensland, especially Mackay, and to growing material from there. But the scientific basis of them is a real inspiration for work to be done there. Lots of people come and work in the gardens, so it's not quite like we have lots of people working in, you know, Kakadu and Uluru and these places who want to come and do research work in Australia. It's not quite that level, but certainly we have a lot of people working in the gardens. The seed collection and the herbarium and the living collection itself is quite an asset, and something very serious that we have to manage properly. So the master plan has given us some ways of doing a bit more of that. The master plan was done of the structural, in the infrastructure, not the gardens, not the plants themselves. That's not included. What I also do is look after the science and the natural resource management work that we do in our other Commonwealth parks. So I actually look after Norfolk Island National Park and Christmas Island National Park, but there's managers and staff on those, but I oversight them. And then also the science and stuff we do in Kakadu, Uluru, and Buderi National Park down at Jarvis Bay. So we've tried to bring that science together, trying to help the staff. There's some really good staff in those places, but they can't, and they're collecting data, massive data, monitoring things, doing the right thing, but they're not qualified to write up a scientific paper or whatever. So what I've done is link them with people in like CSIRO or a university to help them write up all the work they're doing, so they've been getting the information out, because you obviously don't want to just collect the material to not do anything with it. We need to feed it back into the management of the parks. So that's been I think probably the major thing I've done in my life is facilitating linkages and partnerships. And clearly the virtual herbarium was one of those things, and also the Centre for Plant Biodiversity Research, which is still running between our two places. So that's really where, and the gardens has been another one of those linkages within parks itself. So that's all I want to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Judy. That was an amazing journey, and such a pleasure to hear the variety and the influence that you've had personally on so many very important aspects of what are happening. The digital herbarium particularly, mm-hmm. I think, is, as you said, a lot of museums are looking at what you've done and thinking about how access is made available even for collections that we hold, Certainly the lead that you've taken is very inspiring. Do we have any questions for Dr. West?
Thank you so much. That was fantastic. I'm a horticulturalist myself, so I have actually tried using the website to look up different plants and what have you. But
the gardens website?
Sorry?
The gardens website?
Yes, I think, I'm pretty sure I have. Mm-hmm. And there seem to be not so many photos of different things. I mean, when you want bark or you want leaves or what have you, not being a specialist, is there another website behind there that is for the specialists who can log in and look at more images?
Images, yes, there is. Yes, there is.
Okay,
I can. Right. It shouldn't be. You should be able to see it though. If you actually ask, if you Google a plant and for images in Australia, you'll mostly come up with images that are in our collection. So the other collection we have is an image library. So there's about 65,000 images in there, which are almost all available.
Yeah, I think I was actually trying to reverse.
Yes, go the other way. You should be able to go into that thing though and get. But I'll chase it. Maybe I can have a chat to you afterwards and we can follow
thanks.
It up. Yeah.
But thanks so much. That was fantastic.
That's fine.
Hi. Thank you very much, Judy. May I ask two questions, please?
Sure.
How much of Australia's plant life still has to be documented in different ways? And I'll leave it to you to describe which ways they are scientifically. And how does Australia's plant science compare with that of other countries? Are we a pace setter, or do we follow along, or do we contribute significantly? I'd just be curious to know how we compare, please.
Yeah, good question. I'll answer the second one first. In terms of plant sciences and taking it broadly, Australia's well and truly up near the front. I mean, the work that's done in CSIRO and, you know, ANU, some of the bigger, the Melbourne University, leading work in terms of experimental work and physiology, you know, biochemistry, genetics, all those sort of areas. In the systematics area, particularly in taxonomy, where we do the different sort of... Systematics is just like taxonomy, except it's looking at the evolutionary pattern, the family trees, that sort of understanding more detail about organisms. Australia has developed a number of tools, you know, to do some of that work. And working on our own groups, we've done very well, because there's not very many taxonomists in Australia, and that's one of the things that we're really low on, both animal and plant taxonomy. I guess in terms of keeping up with the knowledge of our groups, we've done well, but we're not at the front line. But in terms of quality of people, we are. We've got a lot of really good taxonomists and ones who, you know, have come through for the last 25 years or something. And when you look at what just happened to your PhD students that you've posted before, you feel encouraged that we're getting somewhere. Coming back to your first question, which is about what do we don't know about what we have. So some of you might have heard of Bush Blitz, which is a program that we've been running, which is a discovery program that we have a very significant support with BHP Billiton. So BHP Billiton put $6 million into this, and Australian government put $6 million from our department, and Earthwatch work with us. So this is a program that goes out as a discovery program. So deliberately trying to discover new taxa, and we're trying to work through the National Reserve System, so looking at reserves that have never had a biodiversity survey done. Great multidisciplinary work to be involved in. You know, people go out there and they've got also zoologists, botanists, whatever, all together. And that's been discovering, in 4 or 5 years, 700 and something new species, mostly invertebrates, but there's new plants and new reptiles and fish, those, you know, freshwater fish. But amongst that is new range extensions as well. But the biggest area we don't know about is mosses and liverworts and the lichens, that we know there's a lot there that aren't described, formally described. But there's a difference between, and it's the same with museum collections, difference between what might be formally described and in the literature and everyone knows about, but there might actually be another taxon, there might be quite a lot of specimens in the collection that actually haven't been, someone hasn't recognised them as being something different, or they haven't been described. So there's two different ways of looking at that.
If we have any more, if we don't have any more questions, I'd like
a cup of tea instead.
I'd like to invite you all to join us in the Friends Lounge, and join me again in thanking Dr. Judy West for her wonderful talk.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.